Welcome to Bookswell Intersections. I'm your host, Cody Sisko. Today, my guest is Dr. Melissa Chadburn. Her writing has appeared in the LA Times, New York Times Book Review, the Paris Review Online, and dozens of other places. Her debut novel, A Tiny Upward Shove, was published with Farrar, Straus, and Giroux in April 2022 and was longlisted for the Penn Hemingway Debut Novel Award. She was just awarded her PhD from USC's Creative Writing Program. Welcome, Melissa, and Happy New Year.
Welcome. Thanks for having me. Happy New Year to you, too.
Yeah. We met around a month ago for the WeHo Reads Literary Deathmatch event, and I remember you arrived carrying a box of books, which was instantly endearing because I know all of the unacknowledged labor that goes into building a career in publishing. It's not all virtual hangouts and podcasts like this one. It can be a lot of grinding before the polished stone emerges. You did something that night during your performance that I'll never forget, and I want to briefly describe it for our audience. Three contestants had gone before, and Melissa was the final one up at the mic. She opened a tiny upward shove, poised to start reading, and then she threw the book on the floor. She recited the first three pages from memory, starting with the first line.
Don't believe anyone who tells you that death comes quick and painless. That's bullshit. Dying hurts like fuck all everything. You could feel it all, the hurts, the pains, the wants. There's no numbing dope, no dick wows, no kitty kitty yum yum, just a floodlight on all the world's needs.
Melissa, you write in the book about truly gruesome acts of evil and equally painful bureaucratic tragedies. Could you talk a bit about what drew you to these subjects?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm always drawn to these subjects. I'm very interested in necropolitics, or, you know, who should live and who should die, this concept of deciding how sometimes our nation state decides who can live, who should live and who should die. And I'm interested in what Judith Butler has called grievability. So yes, I've always been interested in those topics. Probably I myself have gone through LA County's foster care system. So that's always been like an obsession of mine. Along with being a creative writer, I consider myself a recovering journalist, and I have reported for a long time on both labor and the child welfare system, particularly child fatalities within LA County's child welfare system. And shortly before actually the book came out, I had been reporting on this particularly harrowing case in LA County that was made into a Netflix docuseries called The Trials of Gabriel Fernandez. And it came out like right at the beginning of the pandemic, right before the like shelter in place orders. So at some point, initially it felt like, oh, wow, like all these people are interested in this thing that I care so much about, or able to sort of engage with this thing that I care so much about that people are not often sort of able to engage with. It was interesting to see that there was an audience for this and for this docuseries. And then we were ordered to stay in place. And so it was kind of like, oh, who turned out all the lights? But I also spent a lot of time both after the series came out and while I was sitting in on the trial, really troubling our ideas of justice, you know, and what construes justice, especially when we're talking about systemic issues, larger systemic issues, and carceral justice programs. So I think this book really allowed me to just take all my tools in my toolbox to this narrative, you know, magic, reporting, actual, and shining a light on systemic breakdowns, whether it be poverty or drug abuse or, our poor misunderstood Aswang figures in Filipino folklore. So, yeah.
I'm thinking in particular, when you say justice, about this moment in the novel where, something truly horrible happens to Marina, and she's separated from her mother and goes and starts her journey in the foster care system. And there's a real question around, you know, is this really what is best for her to be separated from the only sort of care system that she has? Because from that point on, she's really, you know, on her own, except for what is offered by the county in that case, I think.
Right. Yeah. I'm interested in, you know, not only justice, but mercy, I guess, and telling like a larger, fuller story. Like, you know, even the Aswang is sort of saddled with that trope, whether or not to avenge this person's death or, you know, enact mercy. And I just feel like that's a thing that that I was really kind of heavy on the head when I was in this trial. And when the verdict was read, you know, everybody jumped up and hurrahed. That was just one case. And I knew several cases just like it that were taking place mere blocks away from that other case, you know? So I think that that's something that I am always curious about or interested in, is like, what's the deeper solution here? And I think it requires attention. And, you know, when you're developing sort of a witnessing act, like not only a journalist, but all writers and readers, you know, or humans, we are witnessing, you know, and like, what does that mean? And where do I begin and end in my witnessing practice? And I had to learn all this stuff when I went to graduate school, because it was like my only like real sort of academic experience. I mean, I'd gone to lots of other schools before that, but they were like lefty, like commie schools. Like I went to like People's College of Law, and I went to like I went to Antioch. I went to a low residency school, but I went to so USC was like the most traditional school I'd ever attended, and you know, we had to trouble out. We had to do close readings, and you know, it's like a whole new language, but also like I had to think about like what my scholarship was. And a lot of people look at their scholarship as born out of like discourse, which there's something great about that. There are a lot of you know, critical theorists who I think contribute to a larger conversation and are important for us to engage with, and I just think my scholarship is born out of activism and fueled by that discourse, you know, but like is born out of activism. And I think that that's something that is always going to kind of show up in my work.
Mm-hmm. There's, I want to go back a little bit to the tender moments that appear, the kind of witnessing of the mother-daughter relationships or even the relationships that Marina has with her grandmother, for example. Because these are, they're both her formative memories, but they're what she carries even as she goes deeper and deeper into some pretty dark times. You know, could you talk a little bit about those relationships and also how they persist or decay?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this book is sort of a love letter to my Lola, who was like, who, you know, I don't think she would tolerate any of the cuss words in the book, but, I think that she is, one of my favorite stories about my Lola was like, I would be like, you know, I went through a vegetarian stage, which was like very hard for her to understand. And I would be like, you know, Lola, please don't give us any like meat, you know, my friends are coming over, they're vegetarians. And she made macaroni and cheese, but she put like cut up hot dog in it. And I was like, Lola, there's hot dogs in this. She's like, that's not meat, that's pork. Pork is a seasoning. And like, so pork is a seasoning, which is just like, I felt like my Lola was such a loving person, but we were so misunderstood to one another. Like the concept of the foster care system is something that's like not really understood by the Filipino culture either. Like, I think in Filipino culture, oftentimes a child can be perceived, or I'll just say in my experience, a child can be perceived more as a possession than an individual. And I think that was like a really difficult thing to grapple with going into the foster care system, especially as like an older person. And I think that Marina and her mother also had a very similar experience, you know, I think this is common in a mother-daughter relationship as well. Just this idea that like all your successes are hers and all your failures are yours, you know, like, and I think also there's something to be said for like the first generation American child with an immigrant parent, in terms of, there were just like lots of high hopes in terms of like trying to get us out of poverty and things like that. And I think that is also conveyed in the book with Marina and Myrna.
Yeah. That moment, you know, of will they be reunited? Mm-hmm. And it kind of just keeps extending and extending is such a, you know, it's like part of your heart leaking out of the body because eventually it's like, well, maybe they're too far apart and cannot reconcile. And yeah, that was a gut punch. You know, you mentioned poverty, which is one of those important contexts for all of Marina's life. You know, the livelihoods are precarious all around her. Small missteps seem to be magnified by the lack of resources to come back from those. And then when drugs enter the story, the consequences are like devastating and irreversible and inextricably linked with sexual violence as well. I'm wondering like what you think is most important to convey about that kind of mix of poverty and addiction and downward spirals and violence.
Well, I think the first thing I ever published that ever like got any attention was this essay I had written that was published on the Rumpus, and it was called The Throwaways. And on its face, you think it's an essay about a young woman who grows up in poverty in the foster care system. And then by the time it's over, you realize that it's an essay about taxes and how important taxes are to as a tool to distribute wealth. And so that it reached a lot of people. And I was actually working on like a millionaire's tax initiative at the time that I wrote it. And like it got picked up on Marketplace. But the title, The Throwaways, I think is like another thing that has been an obsession of mine, which is, and I wanted to sort of incorporate in the text, which was the book took place in like the late mid 90s, around the same time as the LA uprising. And it was also, there were a lot of kids. There was like a big movement in the foster care system where like welfare reform had just occurred. And then there was like this big movement in the foster care system to reunite families at all expenses. And at the same time, there were like all these serial killers operating in the same place along the Lockheed Highway, going after these women, mostly First Nations women in Canada, but along the Lockheed Highway, they would just target these women. There were like four serial killers at the time operating in the same space. And then over in Vancouver, there were very few beds for co-exposed Hep C, HIV, intravenous drug users who were women. So I just thought, like, I wanted to bring attention to all these groups that can be construed as or were treated as throwaways at this time. And I felt like that the book seemed to be a great vehicle for that. And like 1994 seemed to be a good vehicle for that.
Yeah. And in the book, the Aswang has the quest to, I won't say unearth, but to find, you know, an end for the women who have been disappeared and killed. Where did the Aswan come into your life, and when did you decide to bring that, you know, into the story in a really strong way?
The Aswan is such an interesting figure because, like, she's, every culture has her. I mean, there's like La Llorona, or, you know, she's a figure, I think, who, she's sort of like a vampire or a shapeshifter, or really it depends on what province you're from in terms of what you would interpret her to be, like half wolf, half woman, or like a spinster, you know, a woman who lives by herself, like anybody who's wildly suspicious. And she's really an invention of colonialism. And, you know, when people came to colonize the Philippines, the women had all the power. And so they needed to, you know, warn you, like, beware of that person. She's an Aswang. And nowadays, people will still report on people being Aswang, like in the Philippine Inquirer, like it's everyday news. And so I think that she's like really heavily misunderstood. And I think that she's just like this badass sort of feminist. And this is also sort of my attempt of like the trans-Pacific, you know, intersectional feminist thriller. You know, I say it's that, and it's also just a love story. So even though on its face, there's all this terrible stuff that happens, like at the core of this book is a really sweet kind of love story between these two girls.
Yeah, I want to talk about that. So while Marina's in, you know, the foster care system, she meets Alex, who, you know, they're kind of paired up by feelings of loneliness and, you know, the abandonment that they feel, and also there's something in each other that they respond to and are like magnetically attracted to one another. And without giving any spoilers, the end of their story is, you know, it's really poignant. I wonder what were you thinking about when you were putting these characters together?
Well, I mean, the book is so dark. It's really dark. And I needed something light in there. But also, I'll just tell this story because I tell it to my students all the time, too, which is like when I some friends and I, for the very first time, our first time hanging out, we went to a literary death match. And like it was I was like an adult, like trying to make friends. Wow. And I'm like, okay, so I'm going to go to this literary event with these folks. And at the time it was like in Mid-Wilshire, I think, at like J-Lo's restaurant or something. It was like a big venue. And I went with some friends and we got there a little bit early and we were trying to pass time. And so my friend suggested, her name's Lauren, and she suggested we play this game called Destructo. And the way Destructo works is like you draw something and then you hand the paper to someone sitting beside you and they draw the thing that can destroy that thing. And it can be theoretical or literal, you know? And so I was like, I'm going to win this game because this is my first time hanging out with these people and I really want them to like me. So, and I was like, oh, I know. And I drew a heart, love. Like, what could possibly destroy love? You know, and I handed it to her and she thought for a minute and then she drew like a face with hands on it. Fear destroys love. And it just like went back and forth like that for a while. Love, fear, love, fear, love, fear. And I tell my students, no matter what you're writing, you know, whether it be nonfiction or fiction or whatever, you know, thriller or romance, there's always those two narratives at the core of it, you know, love and fear. So I had to.
There is love in the book. You're right. I mean, it was pretty dark, but it felt also like a love letter to Filipino culture in many ways, in the language and the images, like throughout the narrative. I got that feeling. And I was wondering what that means to you to bring, you know, a debut novel into the world that is such, you know, has a, such a home in that culture?
Oh, it scared the crap out of me. I mean, I...
Love and fear.
Yeah, I love and fear. I mean, because I too grew up in the foster care system. So I did not grow up with my Tagalog speaking relatives. So I have huge, you know, I have imposter syndrome when it comes to anything Filipino. I mean, I remember I was speaking to my cousin's wife's mother. She was like helping me with the language of it. And I would be like, you know, asking her for different words for things. And she'd be like, well, do you mean the tip of the penis or the whole thing, you know? And I would have to like ask her all the time. The other thing is like, and this is like my first time meeting like a semi-distant relative, you know, and I'd be like, okay, but can it be a word like cock, not like penis, you know? Like, just like, and she would always be like, what is this for again? You know, like, but at the same time, like, it was really lovely for me to, I was afraid that, of course, my fear is that a Filipino would open the book and they would be like, this is, what the fuck? You know, this isn't right. This isn't accurate. But I got so much love and acceptance from my community. And I think, you know, the thing about representation is that when there's a dirge of representation, there's so much responsibility on other folks. Yeah. But, and there is a difference between, I guess, representation and recognition. And what's been lovely is to actually receive the recognition, you know, that to have other Filipinos see themselves in the story and have them see me and me see them. It's just been really beautiful.
That's great. Well, thank you, Melissa, for discussing A Tiny Upward Shove. Our audience can find Melissa online at melissachadburn.com. Melissa, thank you for your time.
Thank you.